stage to a massive cheer. When he hit the button and assaulted the room full of metalheads with the soothing sounds of Baby Baby, they revolted and practically started throwing rotten tomatoes at him. He waved his arms in protest, laughing. "I didn't know! I didn't know!" Afterward, he chased me around the dressing room, throwing grapes at me and yelling, "You bastard! You set me up!" He calmed down and worked the room, which included Alice and Slash, telling us how he had recently gone to the hospital convinced he was having a heart attack, only to find out he had just drunk too much coffee. Ah, the life of a rock and roll madman. It was good to see Slash again after first meeting him during a cover shoot for Revolver a year earlier. It had been an awkward first meeting, as it was difficult to have a conversation in between the rock poses and faces we were making for the camera. A few months later, I went backstage after his gig in Toronto to say hi to him and his drummer, Brent Fitz, who I went to high school with in Winnipeg. Fitz wasn't my favorite person back in those days because his band, Seventh Heaven, was always better than my band, Scimitar. They got the better gigs and the better girls, and I'd been jealous of him for that. Then in the early 90s, he'd left Winnipeg to follow his dreams the same way I had. And he'd achieved his goals by getting gigs with Vince Neil, Alice Cooper, and now Slash. We became great friends, and a few years earlier we'd even put together our own all-Canadian tribute band called Coverboy. The idea was we played only songs by Canadian bands like Streetheart, Aldo Nova, Tragically Hip, Kickaxe, and of course, Loverboy. It was a great concept and had so much buzz that our first gig was on top of the CN Tower in Toronto at a party for the 2007 Grey Cup. We had a great show and we were in the hotel lobby afterward when Paul Dean, the original guitar player from Loverboy, got on the elevator with us. Brent knew him vaguely and told him about our band. "That's great," Paul said. "Did you know our original name was Coverboy?"
"No. Why did you change it?"
"Because we wanted something more manly," he said, straight-faced.
"Yeah, I could see that. Forget Slayer or Five Finger Death Punch. When I picture a name dripping with testosterone, I think Loverboy." I hadn't seen Fitz much since the Coverboy gig, so it was great to catch up with him in Slash's dressing room. After a few minutes, Slash was told by his tour manager that he had to leave to go to an official after-show party that had been booked by the venue.
"I don't really want to do it. I'll only go if Jericho comes with me."
I was flattered by Slash's odd request and, of course, agreed to go. We headed over to the Tattoo Rock Club in downtown Toronto, a venue Fozzy had played before and where I got my Fozzy F hand tattoo. And we sat side by side in a back booth in the VIP area as the clock struck midnight. There was a huge tub on the table in front of us, filled with all types of booze provided by the club, who obviously didn't know that Slash had been clean and sober for years.
"Do you drink?" he asked, and when I told him I did, he replied, "Good. I don't drink anymore, but I like hanging out with people who do."
I poured myself a "yeah, boy," and we talked about his career. His favorite guest appearance he'd done was playing with Ray Charles. His wardrobe, his top hat is the original one he bought in the 80s and never leaves his side. And dinosaurs. He was an amateur paleontologist like me. I found him to be extremely intelligent, soft-spoken, humble, and just an all-around great guy. We had an amazing conversation amidst all the beggars and hangers-on, but as soon as the clock hit 1:30 a.m., he must have had a contract to stay for exactly 90 minutes. We were out the door. In the car on the way back to his hotel, he extended the ultimate new millennium show of friendship by following me on Twitter. You can too at I Am Jericho. I asked Fitz later why Slash was insistent on having me accompany him to his appearance.
"Slash likes interesting people, and he wanted to hang out with you. Besides, he really likes you."
"How do you know that?"
"Because he talked to you without his sunglasses on."
I was in Slash's dressing room again after another successful edition of The Golden Gods, headlined by Marilyn Manson. I'd never been a huge Manson fan, but to see him up close from the side of the stage, I finally got his magnetic personality. He was an amazing performer. I was mesmerized by his movements and ominous vibe until he rolled on the floor and exposed his fish-belly white gut. It kind of spoiled the moment to find out that the Antichrist superstar was actually a skinny fat guy, but overall it was a good gig. It got better when Johnny Depp walked on stage and joined Manson on guitar for Beautiful People. He was a pretty good player, too. He had originally moved to Hollywood to be a musician. When that didn't work out, he decided to give the acting thing a try, and I'd say it worked out pretty damn good for him.
After Depp and Manson tore the house down, I closed the show with my final words to the crowd and walked off stage. I ran into Slash, and he asked if I wanted to go up to Manson's dressing room to say hello to Depp. I had a few post-show duties to take care of and told him I'd meet him there. 10 minutes later, I walked up to Marilyn's private dressing room, but before I could open the door, I was stopped by a mountain with eyes.
Can I help you?
Yeah, Slash invited me up here to hang.
I understand, he said, not budging.
But I'm Chris Jericho. I hosted the show tonight and want to say hi to the guys.
I understand, he said, staring straight ahead like a statue.
But Slash is waiting for me in there.
I understand.
You're saying I can't go in?
You understand.
I most certainly did, and skulked away to support the Australian Aborigines like the douche I was. Chapter 41, The End of the World as You Know It. During my time away from the WWE, I noticed a lot of the character traits I'd created during my last run had been, shall we say, borrowed by other superstars. A lot of the heels were now talking slowly and wearing fancy suits, none more blatantly than The Miz. He'd gotten a huge push as the world champion and had even headlined WrestleMania 2011. But it was funny hearing him talking in almost the same cadence and style as me while wearing the expensive clothes. Soon afterward was the rise of CM Punk, who had completely morphed his character into a rogue loose cannon, who said what he wanted, when he wanted. He was getting over huge and calling himself the best in the world, which was a direct rip-off of my the best in the world at what I do catchphrase. I didn't really care, and I wasn't around to dispute him anyway, but I started thinking, what if I was? Ever since I told Vince I was doing DWTS, I'd been waiting for the right time to call him to come back. I didn't want to return to the WWE to just be there. I wanted to have a specific storyline, and I just found it. Best in the world versus best in the world. It was a major angle that I could really sink my teeth into, and I suspected Vince would like it as well. He was a pushover for something that was being done for the first time and boasted a catchy tagline. It wouldn't be the first time Punk versus Jericho locked up. We'd wrestled dozens of times before, and we always worked well together. So I thought a heel Jericho versus a babyface voice of the voiceless CM Punk screamed money. Now that I'd thought of the right angle, I needed to think of the right way to be reintroduced. I was known for my grandiose intros into the company, from the classic Millennium Clock Countdown to the cryptic Save Us vignettes. So the challenge was to come up with something new that was more Return of the Jedi than The Exorcist Part 3. I was listening to Art Bell on the radio talking about how the Mayans had predicted that the end of the world was coming in December of 2012. I started toying with the idea that when I came back to the WWE, it would be the end of the world as you know it. It would be the end of the world because everything that had been going on within the company would change. It would be the end of the Jericho imitators, the end of the raping of my creativity, and the end of CM Punk as the world champion. I thought it was a perfect topical tie-in for all the hoopla surrounding the supposed Mayan disaster coming in 2012. The same way my Millennium Countdown had coincided with the Y2K scare in 1999. My plan was to return during the first Raw of 2012 and start my vignettes a month beforehand. Since it was already August of 2011, I had to move fast, so I contacted Vince's office to set up a meeting with him at WWE headquarters in Stamford, Connecticut. I could have just called him with my plan, but I wanted to pitch it to him in person so he could feel the passion I had for the story and gauge his reaction face-to-face. When I walked into Vince's office, I'd only been there once before in 1999, I think he was genuinely touched when he found out I'd flown up to Connecticut just to see him. After we exchanged a few pleasantries and told a few bad jokes, it was time to get down to business.
So I hear you want Punk at WrestleMania, huh?
I went into my pitch, running down the ideas and the timeline of what I'd come up with. I explained the whole best-in-the-world versus best-in-the-world storyline and how I wanted to make the angle personal, much like when I had punched Sean's wife in the face or removed Ray's mask. I wanted to do something so underhanded it would take our feud to a completely different level. I wanted to tattoo him with my initials. I could think of nothing more humiliating than being branded by another person.
Getting a tattoo was such a personal choice that having to wake up for the rest of your life with your enemy's name carved into your skin seemed like the ultimate violation. I thought Punk would dig the tattooing idea, and Vince seemed to like it as well. I filled him in on the vignettes I wanted to produce to herald my arrival, and he nodded his head and took a few random notes. He mentioned that the Mania plan at the moment was for Punk to defend his title against Alberto Del Rio, but he was interested in my idea. However, he had a problem when I told him I only wanted to sign a 6-month contract.
6 months. Our fans will just be getting used to having you back, and then you're going to leave again?
I explained that the new Fozzy record was coming out in the summer, and we were going on tour to promote it, so there was no way I could stay any longer.
Well, the only other guy I would consider signing for a short-term deal is Shawn Michaels, but you guys are special cases. So, let me think about it and get back to you.
A few days later, Vince called me and agreed to bring me back for a 6-month contract and do Jericho versus Punk at WrestleMania. It didn't take long to figure out the terms of my deal after that, although I didn't get everything I wanted. He still wouldn't budge on paying for my cars or hotels, and he didn't want me to change my ring music. Punk had recently adopted Cult of Personality by Living Color as his new theme, and I wanted to follow his lead and use Nightmare by Avenged Sevenfold for my character's rebirth. But Vince felt it was the wrong move.
You're only coming back for a short time, and I don't want to confuse people. Break the Walls Down will be Chris Jericho's music until the day you stop wrestling.
We discussed my vignettes further, and much like he had with the Save Us videos, Vince decided to leave the creative decisions up to me, Kevin Dunn, and video production whiz Adam Panucci. I'd worked with Adam on both of my previous intros and considered him to be the best in the world at what he does. We spent some time on the phone and I explained to him I wanted something creepy and bleak, something that would get across the apocalyptic tone of the end of the world as you know it. We threw some ideas back and forth until we figured out exactly what we wanted to do and got to work. The vignettes featured faded-out shots of empty fields and playgrounds, and focused on an eerie little boy sitting at a desk in the middle of an empty classroom, quoting scriptures in a weird, nasally voice. Then the camera zoomed in, and the kid ominously said, "It will be the end of the world as you know it." Then, "It begins," flashed on the black screen in white letters. It was sinister, grim, and totally vague, with a dark tone that was the exact opposite of the bombastic, showbiz-style vignettes I'd done the previous times. Kevin Dunn had also decided, instead of airing the piece before a commercial break, to have a YouTube address subtly pop up at the bottom of the screen. He wanted the vignettes to go viral and take off via word of mouth, instead of bashing the fans over the head with them like we'd done in the past. The first link was posted exactly 6 weeks before I was going to make my debut on January 2, 2012, and created an instant buzz. Over 500,000 people clicked on the link during the week, and speculation started immediately about who was returning. Due to the dark nature of the videos, some thought they were for The Undertaker or Kane, characters who had an evil history in the WWE. Others thought they were for me, but then dismissed their own claims, saying they were too dark to represent Jericho. In reality, they were meant to be that way because they were supposed to represent the end of the world, not a new character for me. As the weeks went on, we added more elements to the videos, including a teenage girl who joined Nasal Boy in reciting the scriptures. This caused a whole new wave of controversy as the fans tried to figure out who the girl represented. Was the boy representing The Undertaker and the girl Michelle McCool? Were Chris Jericho and Stephanie McMahon returning to the WWE together? Or was the girl supposed to be Karma? Why I'd be returning with her, I had no idea. Maybe I was the father of her baby? The bottom line, 'cause Stone Chris said so, was that the girl never represented anything. She was just an additional element that Panucci added to increase the weirdness of the videos. Sorry for all the confusion, guys. No matter the theories, people were talking, and they were primed to see who was going to reveal themselves on the first Raw of 2012. The vignettes had done exactly what we needed them to do, create a buzz and prepare the crowd for my arrival. Now it was time for me to prepare for my arrival as well. My first order of business was to call Lance Storm and have him put aside a few days in December for us to train. Lance had been my go-to guy when I was ready to return in 07, and he was the only one I trusted to help me get ready for this return as well. Vince had suggested I go to the FCW Training Center in Tampa, and I loved the idea of working out in my own backyard, but I wanted to stick with the best. If I'm reforming Van Halen, I call David Lee Roth, not Gary Cherone, you dig? Second, I wanted a whole new look for my return. Since everyone was wearing suits in the WWE now, I wanted to ditch that look and go for something completely different, the lurch. But what could that be? I saw a picture of James Hetfield wearing a pair of distressed leather pants at Metallica's MTV Icon tribute, and I thought they looked really fruit. I couldn't find any online, so I googled distressed leather and found a designer in L.A. named Jonathan Logan who made those types of clothes. I shot him an email, and I gave him my idea of a distressed leather jacket with studded rhinestone sleeves. I'd nicked that from Alice Cooper. Jonathan said he could do it, but had a lot of work on his plate, so we decided it would be best for me to come to his shop to brainstorm. I went to a studio in the Fashion District in downtown L.A. and showed him what I had in mind. He came up with a few sketches and said he'd get started as soon as he was finished with his current projects.
"What are you working on now?" I inquired.
"I'm doing all of Justin Bieber's outfits for his next tour. Then I have to make a few jackets for David Lee Roth for the upcoming Van Halen tour."
Well, if that wasn't happenstance, I don't know what was. When I first started in the business, I wanted to be the David Lee Roth of wrestling. And now, by total coincidence, we had the same costume designer. Jonathan also did all of Brad Pitt's leather wardrobe and had just done an outfit for Alicia Keys for a DJ set she had done. He showed me a quick clip of her spinning at the club wearing a jacket with a half-dozen flashing lights sewn on the front. A flashing light went off in my head.
How do those lights work?
They were controlled by a switch in the pocket that turned them on and off like Christmas lights.
If you were able to stitch in a half-dozen lights, could you stitch in a couple hundred?
Of course I could, he replied with real swagger.
And that's how the idea for the famous Jericho lighted jacket was born. Over the next few months, the amalgamation of Hetfield distressed leather, Cooper studded sleeves, and Keys lights came together perfectly. It makes me laugh when people ask me why the WWE doesn't sell lighted jackets at the merch stand. They don't because the damn thing cost me almost $10,000. That's why. Expensive, I know, but I'm sure Paul Stanley said the same thing about Kiss's costumes in 1977. The Star Child knew just as well as I did that in showbiz you have to spend money to make money. Nothing like this had ever been done before, so my original blue and white lighted jacket was a prototype, and it acted as one. Like Clark Griswold's Christmas lights, if one of the hundreds of thin wires in the lining of the jacket broke or malfunctioned, the whole string of bulbs shorted out. The broken wire could be easily fixed with a soldering gun, but the problem was trying to find where the damn thing had snapped off in the first place. But technical difficulties aside, the jacket was the perfect addition to the Y2J legacy, and became a late-career trademark. As a matter of fact, at this point I think they could stick the jacket on a mannequin in the middle of the ring and turn it on, and the fans would be happy. Some legacy, huh? My new look complete, it was time to head up to Calgary to train with Lance and see what I could or couldn't do. While my back problems had pretty much cleared up, I was nervous about how it might feel after taking a few bumps. DDP Yoga had been good enough to band-aid me together during everyday living, but taking bumps in the ring was a whole different world. What if the jarring falls and uncontrolled motions of having a match caused the buzzsaw blades to begin biting again? The only way to find out would be to get back on the horse and ride. I met Lance outside his school on a snowy day in December in suburban Calgary. I'd asked him to keep his students out of the building for the day because I didn't want a group of rookies witnessing me getting carried out of the ring if the pain came back. So it was just the two of us. I'd been told by my amazing Tampa physician, Dr. Chris McLaren, that the worst thing I could do for my back was a lion's salt, my patented backflip off the second rope, and suggested I retire the move for good. So, of course, I decided that was the first thing I was going to try. Go hard or go home, right? I stood in the middle of the ring looking at the middle rope like it was my white whale, scared to try the move, but more scared not to. If I didn't get this out of the way right now, it was going to screw with my entire psyche and affect my training. I had to get rid of the doubt inside my head quickly, because if I didn't, I was going to get hurt. And the only way to conquer the fear was to move full speed ahead and get this funky monkey off my back. It was like passing a car on a one-lane highway with another vehicle approaching. You have to speed by as fast as you can with no hesitation, or risk a head-on collision. I didn't have head-on collision planned on my schedule today, so I said a quick prayer and thought of Joel Goodson's motto. "What the fuck?" I whispered and took off running. I jumped onto the second rope and let my weight force it downward until it reached its nadir. I pushed off with my legs, threw my arms in the air, and tilted my head. I flipped backward, rotated, and landed picture-perfect on my stomach. I lay on the mat for a few seconds, waiting for that burning buzzsaw blade to tear up my insides. But praise God, it didn't happen, and I felt great. Since the spell had been broken and the curse had been lifted, we spent the next few hours having mock matches and running through some of my patented moves to see how they felt. To my pleasant surprise, I pulled them all off pain-free. Codebreakers, crossbody blocks from the top rope, enziguris, bulldogs, walls of Jericho. They all felt better than ever, especially the codebreaker, which had always seemed to hurt me more than my opponent. Since I came back in 2007 with my new finish of the codebreaker, I wanted to come back in 2012 with a new move as well. I had the idea of doing a sliding forearm to the face and calling it Apocalypse Now. I practiced the move a dozen times with Lance, making tweaks along the way. It looked badass, and I was excited to start using it as soon as I returned. I texted Vince to tell him that I had a new finishing move, and his reply was typical McBad comedy.
"You already have a finish. Looking at the lights."
Hardy frickin' har. I actually only used the move once during a match with Kofi Kingston in Dubai. But I decided I didn't have the time or the patience to get it over, and I gave up on it after a few weeks. So if you want to use Apocalypse Now as your new finish, fearless readers, be my guest. Now that I was warmed up and ready to return to the grueling full-time WWE schedule, my free time was about to be cut down significantly. So before I went back, I wanted to do one last thing for myself and check out one of the Metallica XXX anniversary shows in San Francisco. I'd been contacted a few months before by Lars' assistant to see if I would do a short video congratulating them on their 30-year career, and was blown away. To be asked by the mighty Metallica to give my thoughts on their legendary career for these monumental shows was a huge honor. I whipped up a 90-second soliloquy praising them for all they'd accomplished and thanked them for all they'd done for me. No matter what I've been through in my life, Metallica has always been there for me. Thanks to James, Lars, Kirk, Cliff, Jason, and Robert for always having my back, I concluded. Then Lars invited me to come to as many of the four shows as I could. My schedule was pretty packed as I had a lot to prepare for with my return only weeks away, so I was only able to go to the first show. But it was one of the best nights of my life as a musician and a fan, because it was something that had never been done by a band and might never happen again. Over the course of the four shows, Metallica played a whopping 80 songs encompassing their entire career. Rare tracks, instrumentals, songs they'd never played live before, some of their famous covers joined by the original guys who played them, and all in front of a small number of lucky hardcore fans who'd won tickets from their fan club. I walked into the 1,200-capacity Fillmore in downtown San Francisco with Spiwee and good friend Brian Slagle, the founder of Metal Blade Records, and Huge Hockey Nut, and saw it had been transformed into a veritable Metallica museum. They had assembled an amazing collection of rare metallic artifacts, including Lars' infamous early 90s white leather jacket, the Gibson Explorer that James was playing when he was horribly burned by a pyroblast, just like The Undertaker, rare posters from their early days, and a jean jacket once worn by my hero, Cliff Burton. We waited for the show to start in the VIP balcony as a New Orleans brass band played instrumental versions of Metallica tunes, and various dignitaries milled about, including Jason Newsted, who was rejoining the band for the first time in a decade to play a few songs. Then I was introduced to Biff Byford, the lead singer of Saxon, one of my favorite bands, who was there to sing his band's classic Motorcycle Man with Metallica. When I was 14, I only asked for one present for Christmas. The Crusader album by Saxon. I gushed to Biff like a teenager. Then I was taken to meet Cliff Burton's 80-year-old father, Ray, and was kind of starstruck. I couldn't believe I was standing next to my hero's dad, and he was so fruit to talk to, standing there wearing his Cliff Burton t-shirt and Metallica button. One of the highlights of my fanboy career, for sure.
Meanwhile, the various tribute videos were playing on a big screen to the crowd, some getting massive responses. Lemmy. Others getting booed out of the building. Avril Lavigne. My video aired in a great slot between Michael Schenker and you two, and I'm proud to say I got a bigger cheer than Bono, who's still awesome. Hashtag Lion's Tale callback. I was laughing to Slagle about the response to my video when I saw a skinny tall dude with a faux hawk standing in the corner trying so hard to look like Hetfield it was pathetic. The guy walked toward me and I realized it was Hetfield. I couldn't believe how great he looked and how much weight he'd lost since I'd last seen him 8 months ago at the Big Four show in Indio, where he'd been getting quite beefy. He told me how much he appreciated my video and how much it meant to them. After some small talk, I was still a little tongue-tied to be talking to James. I asked him how he got into such good shape. "I've been doing the caveman diet," he said simply. Caveman diet? I hadn't heard of that before. James explained that it consisted of eating only meat, chicken, fish, berries, nuts, eggs, and vegetables. Basically no breads or carbs, processed foods or sugars. You only ate what a caveman could hunt or forage from the land. But didn't cavemen only live until they were like 30 years old? Yeah, but that's because they all got eaten by dinosaurs, James said with a smirk. All jokes aside, the concept sounded interesting, and DDP had been urging me to start a gluten-free diet anyway. So if the caveman diet was good enough for Papa Het, it was good enough for me. I started it the next day, lost 10 pounds in the first 3 weeks, and have stuck with it ever since. I've changed its name to the Hetfield Diet, much to Zach Wilde's chagrin, and don't even consider it a diet anymore. It's just the way I eat. So if you are looking to drop a couple pounds, I strongly suggest it. I spent the rest of the night drinking Yeah Boys. Cavemen had vodka, didn't they? And going nuts with one of my favorite bands as they celebrated their career with their closest fans. I ended up in the photo pit thrashing all around, acting like a maniac, but I was interfering with the cameramen who were filming the show, and was asked to move by their head of security, Big Mike. "But James said I could stand here," I lied. Big Mike shook his head and dragged me out of the pit by my ear like I was 7 years old. A few minutes later, back in the safety of the balcony, I texted Triple H, who'd also done a video, to tell him mine had gotten a much bigger pop. It had. And he asked why wasn't I home watching Raw. I laughed, but it would only be a few more weeks before I was watching Raw. This time, live and in person. Chapter 42. CM Drunk. The first Raw of 2012 was in Memphis, Tennessee, but to keep the hellhounds off my trail, I flew into Nashville, over 200 miles away, instead. Even though most of the fans suspected by that point that I was the one behind the End of the World videos, I wanted to keep my return as much of a secret as possible. The best way to do that was to avoid the fans who waited at the airport for autographs and would instantly post the news of my arrival online if they saw me. Alas, my careful efforts to go incognito were in vain. I was somehow spotted at the Nashville airport. A picture of me standing stoically in the baggage claim holding my black leather computer bag by my side was posted within minutes. As soon as I saw it, I counterattacked by tweeting a recent picture of me, Spiwi, and the very wise Chad snowboarding in Banff, and claimed it was from that day, which started an online debate as to my whereabouts. A few minutes later, fans began posting photoshopped pictures of me standing stoically with my leather bag at famous landmarks around the world, like a bizarre Where's Waldicho. There I was standing next to the pyramids in Egypt, on the grassy knoll during the Kennedy assassination, and my personal favorite, crossing Abbey Road with the Beatles. I drove to Memphis and parked my car on a dark side street close to the arena, then was picked up by a black sedan and escorted under the cover of night by Bruno Lauer to a backstage bus to await my cue. Toward the end of the show, the last of my vignettes played to the live crowd and ended with a nasal boy saying ominously, "The end of the world as you know it begins now." The lights went down and the fans were humming like a bird waiting for something big to happen. I hadn't been gone long enough for them to forget who I was like they had for my 2007 return, so this time when my patented Break the Walls Down war cry resounded through the arena, they went ballistic. I hurried out on stage in total darkness and hit the switch inside the pocket of my new accoutrement, fun word, powering on the hundreds of blue lights crisscrossing the jacket
and turning me into a new millennium version of the Electric Horseman, sans swank 70s Robert Redford mustache. When the lights illuminated and I appeared on stage, the crowd went wild, which was all fine and el dandy, except I was supposed to be the bad guy, remember? Even though I'd ended my last run as a heel, I'd now reached the status where people were excited to see me no matter what side of the fence I was on. Panucci had anticipated this reaction when we were working on the videos and suggested, to remedy it, I take away the thing that my fans loved about me the most. My mouth.
What if, after all this build-up and hoopla, you came to the ring and said absolutely nothing?
I loved it. By staying silent, I'd be verbally blue-balling all the Jerichoholics who were excited to see me again. Everyone would be expecting some witty repartee or my famous catchphrases, but by not giving them what they wanted, I'd leave them feeling ripped off, confused, and less apt to cheer for me the next week. I strutted down to the ring, but as soon as I stepped through the ropes, the jacket's entire right arm of lights went dead. I must have snapped a wire with my movements, as the fragile electronics weren't designed to withstand that sort of expansive motion. But it didn't matter. The crowd was hot, hot, hotter than hell, and I stood there for 5 minutes with a shit-eating grin on my face, basking in their glory and holding the mic in front of my mouth. Then I dropped it on the mat and retreated out of the ring, still grinning. Vince's first comment when I came through the curtain was, "Your jacket broke already?" Well, that was rotten. But besides my wardrobe malfunction, he loved the segment. So much so that he decided he didn't want me saying anything at all until my first match 3 weeks later at the Royal Rumble. I thought it was a great idea and spent the following weeks thinking of creative ways not to say anything during a promo. I came out the next Monday and pulled the Silent Bob gimmick again, this time welling up with fake tears at the reaction I was getting and mouthing the word, "Why?" A trick I stole from Hulk Hogan, who had done the same thing during a huge crowd reaction in Montreal a decade earlier, as the fans wondered what the hell I was doing. The next week, I came to the ring with a t-shirt gun and shot merch into the crowd while screaming, "Yeah, yeah," for no reason in particular. The crowd was onto me at this point and knew I was trolling them, but instead of booing, they just got apathetic. The reactions got better during the Rumble match when I made it to the final two with Sheamus, but it confused the crowd when he eliminated me and won. I thought it would have been better for the Best in the World feud for me to win the Rumble, but the decision was made to go with my favorite Irishman instead. Finally, the night after the Rumble, I broke the silence and did a long promo about how the talent in the WWE had robbed me of all my ideas and inventions. The suits, slow-talking promos, high-flying moves, sparkly tights, anything I could think of, I took credit for. The Chris Jericho invented everything gag is still as popular as ever. I even read a tweet today saying Chris Jericho invented Chuck Norris. Finally, I zeroed in on the catchphrases and called out Punk for stealing mine, which drew the ire of the crowd and Punk himself. He was the most over babyface in the company, and his reaction was off the charts when the opening riff of Cult of Personality played. The fans were looking forward to seeing the two of us butting heads in a verbal duel, and we gave them what they wanted. "So you invented everything, huh? Did you invent Canada, too?" he smirked. Then he got serious. "While you were off dancing with the stars, I was here swimming with the sharks." Such a great line, alluding to how he'd conquered the WWE machine with his new character. At the end of the 15-minute segment, the battle lines had been drawn, and the WWE universe was ready to see who really was the best in the world. The thing I admired most about Punk was, like me, when he said he was the best in the world, he truly believed it. We were a lot alike and had come through the ranks of the WWE the same way, as did Shawn Michaels. Both of us accused of being egomaniacal, arrogant, and hard to deal with because we had confidence in our abilities. Neither one of us had been groomed to be world champions from the start. We'd gotten to the top by being all-around performers who could make anybody look good and stood firm in our beliefs to take no shit from anybody, including each other. A few years earlier, in 2010, we had a live event in a little barn of a building in Amarillo, Texas, on the same day Canada was playing for the Olympic gold medal in hockey against the United States. It was a monumental battle between the two biggest rivals in hockey history, and as a Canadian, I was excited to watch it. The afternoon's match was Punk and me versus Morrison and Edge, and since we were all familiar with each other's styles,
We agreed to call the match in the ring and not get together beforehand so that Edge and I could watch the game. We sat on the crew bus and watched Canada beat the U.S. in overtime, with the final goal scored just as my ring music began. Punk started the match and did a few spots with Morrison and then Edge. I stood on the apron waiting for the tag, but he kept ignoring me. He stopped Edge and started getting heat on him, but still didn't tag me in. I started getting hip to the fact that he planned on working the whole match himself. I stood on the apron watching him do all the work and munch some popcorn from a ringside fan, until Morrison finally got the hot tag and pinned him. I wasn't selling it outwardly, but inside I was fucking pissed, especially when a fan hit me in the back of the head with an empty Pepsi can as I walked to the back. I called the four of us into the trainer's room after the match and asked Punk what his problem was. He opened up instantly and admitted he felt Edge and I had been unprofessional in watching the hockey game instead of putting together the match beforehand. I wasn't having any of it, and exploded right back. You can't call a match in the ring? I don't need to explain myself to anybody in this arena, never mind you. And you want to talk about unprofessional? If one person out there bought a ticket to see me, you just took that away from them. If you had a problem with me watching the game, you should have said something back here, not in the ring. What you did out there was fucking unprofessional. We agreed to disagree, but to this day I still feel he was out of line. Although I have to admit the guy has balls. It's one of the reasons why I requested to work with him, and one of the reasons why I knew he would be into the idea of me tattooing my initials on him. I ran the idea past him, and he agreed it was a great way to take our feud to a completely different place from any of the others on the show. He even offered to fly his regular tattoo artist in from Chicago to teach me how to do the simple procedure. But we still needed final approval from Vince, who had strangely been avoiding the subject whenever I asked him about it. When I got to the arena in Boston before Raw, I found out from Michael Hayes why Vince was ducking me. He doesn't want to do the tattoo angle. He found out that people bleed when they get inked and is totally against it now. I still wanted to hear Vince's reasoning for myself, so I went and asked him why he'd canceled the angle. He admitted he was concerned about seeing even a few drops of blood, but he also felt that tattooing Punk wasn't all that big a deal. He's got so many already. What would one more even matter? Plus, it would be so small that nobody would even care, Vince, who had no tattoos, explained. I pointed out that it didn't matter how big the tattoo was or how many Punk had. I was violating him, and he would have to live with that every day. I could tell by his expression that Vince was rethinking his decision, but then he went back to his fear that tattooing Punk might make him bleed, and I knew I'd lost the battle. But in typical McMahon fashion, even though he'd nixed my idea, he had an alternative. I know Punk's dad had some drinking issues. Why don't we use that? You can accuse Punk of being one drink away from ending up an alcoholic just like his father. It was a heavy subject, but if going there took the fans to that different emotional level and legitimately made them angry, I was all for it. But was Punk? He was, and immediately waved off any concerns and felt we should go for it all the way. That night, I went on Raw and told millions of people worldwide that CM Punk's father was an alcoholic, and Punk himself was such a failure that it was just a matter of time before he ended up the same way. I got a serious, reaction when I dropped that bomb, and the few remaining Y2J fans soured on me pretty quickly. It was an uncomfortable subject for a lot of people as it hit them pretty close to home. Every day I read on my social media pages how much of an asshole I was for using something as serious as alcoholism in a wrestling angle. But that's precisely why I was doing it. Now people legitimately wanted to see Punk kick my ass. But the angle was so strong that Vince began to have second thoughts about what kind of match he wanted us to have at WrestleMania. The following week on the last Raw before the PPV, Michael Hayes once again delivered some bad news.
Vince doesn't want you guys to have an actual match at Mania. He feels you've gone too far with the alcoholic thing to go out there and do high spots. He wants you to have a 10-minute brawl and end with Punk getting DQ'd for not breaking the count when he has you in the ropes.
Talk about a shitty finish for one of the main events of WrestleMania. I originally wanted the match with Punk because I thought we could have a modern-day Steamboat Savage classic. But things had changed, and Vince did have an interesting point. I'd taken things way too far by bringing Punk's family into the fray, and had almost peaked the angle too soon. In retrospect, we should have started the alcoholic father storyline after our Mania match.
the same way Sean and I used Rebecca to ramp up our feud after already working each other for a few months. But now it was too late, and we had painted ourselves into a corner. Neither Punk nor I wanted to give up on having some semblance of an actual match, but Vince's mind was set. I think the only thing that saved us from the quick DQ finish was that Sheamus was winning the world title from Daniel Bryan in 18 seconds on the same show. And after some serious discussion, Vince decided he didn't want two short world title matches. So he compromised by adding a stipulation that if Punk got disqualified in any manner, he would be stripped of the title. That way he wouldn't be able to get completely ballistic on me because he'd have no choice but to follow the rules. I thought that was a pretty clever solution, and now that we had our marching orders, all we had to worry about was the match itself, and I was going to do everything I could to make it a classic. Since I was in one of the three main events at the biggest show of the year, I wanted to do something special for my entrance into the Sun Life Stadium in Miami. I was the heel, so I wouldn't be getting zip lines or elaborate spaceships lowering into the ring like Edge had a few years ago, nor did I want Stay Puffed Marshmallow inflatable letters spelling out my name like Miz had. So it was up to me to think of something original. I called Jonathan Logan again and asked him to make a new jacket with five times as many lights as the first one. He created a masterpiece that boasted more bulbs than a greenhouse, with a remote control that both turned the lights on and changed the speed at which they blinked. He'd also included a zipper in the lining to make it easier to get to the broken wires, which happened on a weekly basis, and when opened, the electronics pattern looked like a damn NATO circuit board. The jacket was heavy, and Jonathan said if he made the same one for Justin Bieber, his slight frame wouldn't be able to support it. I'm sure David Lee Roth could have worn two of them and done a spinning roundhouse kick at the same time, because he was David Lee Roth. I wasn't sure my financial frame could support it either, because this one was even more expensive than the first one. How much? Let's just say I paid $400 for my first car, a 76 Velaire, and this jacket was 37.5 times that. But it was WrestleMania, dammit, and using the Paul Stanley theorem, I was once again going to spare no expense. Plus, the jacket looked like it was worth every penny and was going to be one of the visual highlights of the PPV. I spent the day of the show in the bowels of the Sun Life Stadium doing yoga, talking to Punk about the match, and doing a press conference with new WWE Hall of Famer Mike Tyson, where I forgave him for betraying me and knocking me out the last time we saw each other. Afterward, I walked out onto the massive stadium stage and took in the thousands of empty seats, thinking about how amazing a phenomenon WrestleMania was. Vince was coming up the rampway, and I asked him, "Do you ever just take a minute to reflect on all this?" "You should, man. What you've accomplished is incredible." He looked at me strangely for a moment, then turned and surveyed the stadium for a good 10 seconds. Then he looked back at me and said, "Thanks for that, Chris. Now let's get to work." When I got back to the dressing room, everyone was giving me weird looks and giggling. I asked what was up, and they finally gave in and showed me pictures of Christian and Brodus Clay parading around the dressing room in my jacket, one looking like a broom covered in a bedsheet, and the other the epitome of fat guy in little light-up coat. Finally, it was showtime, and I was taken around the stadium to the gorilla position in a golf cart, switching my jacket on and off to make sure there were no issues. I didn't want a reprise of the night I debuted my blue jacket and have it conk out, but now satisfied that this new one worked perfectly, I was ready to rock. I paced around Gorilla as the pre-match hype video played, waiting to hit the stage and make history. The package ended and I turned my jacket on one last time to make sure it worked properly before my music hit, and it did. On one side. The lights on the left part of the jacket flashed brighter than a thousand suns, but the lights on the right were darker than Darth Vader. I couldn't believe I'd paid 15 fucking grand for this thing, and it was already broken. The stupid jacket threw me completely off my game. I was so ticked off I totally forgot about my match because I was too busy thinking of how I was going to keep 75,000 people and Vince from noticing that only 15% of my amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat was working. I came out onto the stage leading with my left side so the cameras could only see the lighted part of my jacket. Then I lurched down the 150-foot rampway sideways like Bela Lugosi holding his cape in front of his face, pulled the strings, doing my best to make sure the camera could only shoot the flashing side.
I didn't know if I was fooling anybody, but I was never so relieved to hear Punk's music in my life, so I could finally take the jacket off. My wardrobe malfunctioned behind me. Punk and I had an excellent match. I started by trying to goad Punk into getting disqualified by taunting him about his father and begging him to hit me with a chair. He came close to losing it, but held on to his emotions and decided to take out his frustrations on me by kicking my ass the old-fashioned way. We jam-packed the bout with killer spots, including me suplexing Punk over the top rope all the way to the floor, me catching him in the walls as he was going for a top rope Frankensteiner, and him diving on me halfway across the floor from the top turnbuckle. It climaxed with an intricate series of reversals and rollouts that ended up with me tapping out to his Anaconda Vice submission. Overall, I was very happy with the match, and while it wasn't the Steamboat and Savage classic I'd originally envisioned, I think it's underrated. In my view, it was better than the Rock versus Cena contest that closed the show, and ended up as the second best on the card behind Taker Triple H, which tore the house down. I think some fans had such high expectations for our match that it fell short in their eyes, but it didn't to me. I dug it, and was excited to continue working with Punk as we were only getting started. The next night, on Raw in Miami, I claimed that not only did Punk's dad have a drinking problem, his sister was a junkie as well. Then after he got crushed by Mark Henry, I came down to insult him even further by pouring whiskey over his head. I was hell-bent to make sure he fulfilled his drunken destiny one way or another. When I pushed my way through the crowd to approach the fallen Punk, I had a Jack Daniels bottle made of the dreaded sugar glass and filled with iced tea in my hand. Originally, Vince had insisted that actual Jack be used to fill up the bottle, but I balked at the idea considering that Punk really was straight-edge, and I didn't want him swallowing a mouthful of the real stuff. Besides, who was going to know? "People in the front row will know it's not real alcohol if they can't smell it," Vince claimed, which reminded me of Ed Langley's thoughts about ether from 22 years earlier. So we were going to pour actual alcohol over a Tito Taller's head just to impress 20 people sitting at ringside? Finally, Vince acquiesced and switched it to tea, but then we had a lengthy discussion about whether I should smash the bottle over Punk's head or not. Vince was concerned that Punk might get cut, and I thought of how much things had changed since 2002, when Kane had thrown me through a sugar glass picture window and I spent the rest of the night picking dozens of sugar slivers out of my back. Punk was insisting I smash it over his head, but Vince was reluctant and wanted me to hit the ring post just above his noggin instead. Either way was fine with me, as I knew the angle was going to be a standout no matter what. We went through it a few times, and the props guy warned me not to swing the bottle too fast so it didn't break apart in the air before making contact. I hopped over the barricade and slowly stalked my prey, wearing a swank pair of Jonathan Logan distressed leather pants, pointed dress boots, and no shirt. If I was going to trample on a man's dignity, I was going to do it with style. "Here's to you, Punk," I taunted, raising the bottle in the air and slowly pouring the sweet amber over his head. It streamed through his hair, down his face, and into his mouth as he vainly attempted to spit it out, as the crowd's hostility toward me hung in the air like the southern Florida humidity. I scoped the audience, secretly impressed with their reactions, and decided to stomp Punk in the face for the final coup de grace. As I lifted my left foot in the air to deliver the fatal crushing blow, my right foot slipped in the pool of iced tea and I fell on my ass. It was the worst thing that could have happened at the worst time. There was no getting out of it, no way to cover it up. It was like Jason Voorhees raising his machete over his head to kill a helpless co-ed and slipping on a banana peel. I had killed the intensity, and the impact of the attack disappeared like a thief in the night. I ain't talking about Bruce Kulick, once I'd busted my tail. All I could think to do was completely ignore the fall, pop right back up on my feet, and smash the bottle over his head. It exploded a millisecond before it made contact for the blown spot daily double. I had botched the angle big time. Can you imagine what would have happened if I had slipped and fallen as I was about to punch Rebecca Michaels? Stupid pointed dress boots. We got back on track the next week when I accused Punk's mother of illicit behavior and claimed Punk was a bastard, which to Vince was the ultimate insult. Not sure if being called a bastard would win any best insult awards, but it was better than the worst insult I've ever heard, delivered by The Miz. We were in Montreal, and he was berating the crowd in French about all of the things he hated about the city,
their language, their hockey team, their specialty foods.
Je déteste Montréal. Je déteste les Canadiens. Je déteste poutine, he screamed.
What? He hates poutine? That tasty concoction of French fries drowned in gravy and covered with cheese curds? I'm gonna kill him!
Poutine insults aside, referring to Punk as a bastard seemed like a pretty lame put-down to me, so I decided to add an additional insult of my own. During my previous attack, some of the Jack Daniels tea had gotten down his throat, so in my mind I'd done what I had promised and gotten him to take his first taste of alcohol. So I deemed him CM drunk. Then I attacked him again and this time poured an entire six-pack of beer over his head. But this time I didn't slip, and the attack worked like a drunken charm. At the next Raw in Detroit, I cheekily had a liquor basket delivered to him during his in-ring promo. That seemed to be the last straw for poor old Punk, as later in the show I went spying on him in his dressing room and saw him sodomizing a cat. I'm just making sure you're still paying attention, fearless listeners. What I really saw when I peeked into the dressing room was CM sitting in the corner, surrounded by empty bottles from the liquor basket. Now that I had actually gotten him drunk with my evil trickery, my conspiracy plan was ready to take the next step. I found a little-known codicil in the WWE talent contract that said if a performer was drunk during a show, he would be fired. In Punk's current state of intoxication, he would be stripped of the title, and since I was the number one contender, the title would go straight to me. At least that's the way I saw it. The next step of my plan was bringing out a pair of Detroit cops to administer a roadside DWI test on him. If they determined he was over the limit, he'd be terminated and relieved of his championship duties immediately. I called him out, and a few seconds later he wobbled down to the ring, slurring his speech slightly and doing an overall great job of acting drunk. Even though he never partied for real, Punk always hung out with the boys until the wee hours of the morning, so he'd been around plenty of drunks in his life, myself at the top of the list, and knew how to play it perfectly. The cops made him balance on one leg and count to 10, walk a straight line, and then asked him to say the alphabet backward. When I pitched the idea to the writers that Punk should actually recite the letters backward, I was shot down and told that nobody could do that even if they were sober. So I wrote down the alphabet backward, memorized it for 20 minutes, and enumerated all 26 letters to the writers in reverse order, without error. Punk now did the same, although he got the R and the T mixed up, slowly picking up the speed of his delivery before dropping his drunk act and revealing that he'd been faking it the whole time to trick me. When he finished with the letter A, he punched me in the face. It was an entertaining segment that set the stage for our blow-off match, an extreme street fight in Punk's birthplace, Sweet Home Chicago. The Windy City crowd was as raucous as always, my favorite wrestling crowd in the U.S., and we had a perfect match, even better than Mania, in my opinion. We wore the old-school 80s street fight uniform, a pair of jeans with knee pads and boots pulled over the top, and taped fists. Then we beat the holy hell out of each other with kendo sticks, which left me with some wicked welts on my back, garbage cans, ring bells, and all sorts of other assorted plunder. Punk's sister, Chaylene, was in the front row and got revenge on behalf of her family by slapping me in the face hard when I taunted her. Punk used that momentum to put me through the announce table with an elbow from the top rope and then sprayed me in the face with a fire extinguisher while I had him in the walls of Jericho. I was so worried about closing my eyes to protect them from the spray that I forgot to close my mouth and swallowed some of the weird white frozen foam. Not the healthiest of snacks, but for the next few days I didn't have to blow on hot food before I ate it. He eventually finished me off with the GTS, and the Punk Jericho feud was officially in the books, at least on TV. But the angle was so hot we continued working together in different countries all over the world, wowing the crowds with our magic tricks. There was one country in particular, though, that wasn't too happy with me or my tricks. Chapter 43, Professional Flag Kicker. The WWE tours all over the world, but when we were invited to perform in China for the first time ever, it was a major coup. We'd been on TV over there for years, but it was hard to make any headway due to all the other entertainment options in the country, and the fact that the Chinese government didn't really understand what we did. But they wanted to book us as one of the few American acts to perform at the 2010 World Expo in Shanghai,
along with a symphony orchestra and a Right Said Fred concert. I keyed, but what a mental image. We were in the middle of an Asian tour and flew to Shanghai from the Tokyo Haneda Airport, which was jam-packed with chain-smoking Japanese businessmen. We were told to wear suits on the plane to make a good first impression in China, which was a good idea in theory, but Haneda was so smoky and stuffy that I wanted to barf all over my sweet Hugo Boss ensemble. Thankfully, I made it to Shanghai without hurling, and when we landed, we headed straight to the venue. As we drove through the city, I marveled at the brilliant architecture of the immaculately constructed buildings, each one seeming more beautiful than the last, as if the designers were playing a game of one-upmanship with each other. We arrived at a gorgeous multi-tiered arena that looked like a fortress and was about as hard to get inside as one. Armed guards checked our passports and looked through our bags multiple times before allowing us entry. Backstage workers and security guards buzzed around doing a whole lot of nothing and wearing very concerned looks on their faces as they did it. I was whisked away to a press conference and placed in front of a gang of suit-clad reporters with nary a smile among them. They asked me generic questions and I responded with sarcastic and comical answers that would have brought the house down in any other country. But not with this lot. Either the translator wasn't properly relaying my words or these guys had no sense of humor. "Is it illegal to laugh in China?" I deadpanned. Nobody laughed, in fear of incarceration, apparently. As strange as the press conference was, the show itself was even stranger. We were briefed beforehand that the show was sold out, but we weren't allowed to punch or choke our opponents, and under no circumstances could we do anything on the floor. If we did, the government officials would shut down the show, as they were skittish about having us there in the first place. But when I walked out for my match, I was surprised to see a largely empty arena with nobody on the floor and only a few pockets of fans scattered around in the stands. Directly in front of the ring was a long table decorated with bunting and flowers, and sitting behind it was a group of diplomats in tuxedos like something out of a James Bond movie. I guess they wanted the best seats in the house to witness this barbaric display of Western entertainment. But the strangest part was that the upper deck was jam-packed with rabid fans screaming and cheering our every move like teenage girls at a One Direction concert. Besides the upper deckers, though, the rest of the meager audience sat on their chopsticks and did nothing. A sold-out show usually meant a lively, standing-room-only crowd in a packed house. What kind of sellout was this? Later I found out that all the tickets had been bought by the government, which then distributed a small portion to the fans and threw away the rest because they were afraid a riot was going to break out. Guess nobody had filled them in that we were entertainers and not actual blood sport fighters. What the Chinese government didn't understand about the WWE, the government in Dubai did, and we were treated like royalty during our three-night stand in Abu Dhabi. I noticed the audience was wearing an interesting mix of fashions, some in Western-style street clothes, others in traditional Muslim garb. I was teaming with R-Truth, and during his rap sing-along entrance, it was hilarious to see people in burqas and keffiyehs hopping out of their chairs, raising the roof and chanting, "What's up?" like something out of the Naked Gun. Much like Shanghai, Abu Dhabi was immaculate and boasted spotless streets lined with perfectly groomed shrubbery, and every car on the street seemed to have been built within the last few years. We were staying 30 minutes outside the city in a brand-new entertainment complex complete with 5-star hotels, a waterslide park, a Ferrari theme park, and bars and restaurants everywhere. There was even a Tim Hortons. After the show, we went to have a few drinks at a posh nightclub on the top floor of one of the hotels. I was enjoying a fine "yeah, boy," and minding my own business when a mean-looking, balding dude with dark skin, a unibrow, and a bad attitude started barking orders at us in Arabic. He was obviously drunk and not very happy that the American, "I'm from Winnipeg, you idiot," pigs were invading his territory. He finished his tirade and his friends started laughing at Unibrow's witty repartee. He went back to the bar, but he had rubbed me the wrong way, and I thought I'd give him a little what for. So I followed him and, without a second glance, threw my shoulder into his back with a solid twist. Uni was off balance, so my little nudge caused him to lose his footing, and he stumbled into the wall as I disappeared through the crowd. Apparently he didn't appreciate my love tap, and was waiting for me outside when we left the bar about an hour later. Uni and his crew were lined up on the curb and looked pretty intimidating in their black sport coats.
I hoped I hadn't gotten in over my head, but just in case the situation got out of control and I had to take a swing at someone, I stuck my old-school hotel room key, didn't know they still made these, in between my first and middle fingers.
"Hey, motherfucker, I've been waiting for you,"
Uni said, looking like Samuel Jackson but sounding like Michael Jackson. "I see that," I replied, fingers clenched around my weapon.
"You just made a big mistake, Big. My father..."